This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program. We won't be taking your phone calls today, but stay tuned for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mueller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mueller Program. You've heard of her, Bridezilla. In this case, it is the bride of the wedding that got out of control. And the matter of fact is that we're now facing an out-of-control wedding culture in America. And with the average wedding now costing upwards of $27,000, and with the wedding itself becoming the big focus rather than marriage, and with the Christian understanding of what a wedding is all about being eclipsed by cultural expectations, we face the big question, and that is, why are Christians giving themselves over to this wedding culture? And by the way, it's big. This, not only this time of the year, but 12 months out of the year now. It has become a $39 billion a year business, just getting people married. And, of course, in this postmodern age, that's not all there is to it, is there? It's getting people remarried and even remarried again. And you're talking about the wedding becoming a cultural event of consumerism, advertising social status, and sometimes very strange romantic expectations, but not focusing on marriage. And we're going to be talking today with an author who has a great deal to say about this. Rebecca Mead has written a book entitled One Perfect Day, The Selling of the American Wedding. And when I started reading it, I couldn't put the book down because rarely have I seen a social observer so nail a phenomenon. We're going to be having her on the program. We're going to be talking about some of the statistics related here and also some of the anecdotes that tell us where we are. And you're going to join the conversation by calling 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. And, folks, I recognize that as I announce this is the topic of the program today, I run the risk of alienating one half of the world's population, that is the female half. But this is the kind of conversation we have to have. And one of the things we're going to be looking at is how the church has capitulated even on theological principle just to keep people happy at weddings. The phone number again, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. At my website, albertmueller.com, overnight I published an article entitled, We're All Moralists Now. And of course we are. The background to this is an article by Andrew Ferguson at the Weekly Standard in which he makes the point that everyone has a moral cause. He starts with the news that movies featuring characters who smoke, that is, smoke cigarettes, are now going to be given a more restrictive rating. No kidding. Now, this is what's really going on here. Folks are looking at the movies, and the same folks that have so corrupted the rating system so that the ratings tell us basically nothing are now, in their political correctness, focusing on tobacco. What's next? Trans fats? In other words, you have a rating system that might allow sexual promiscuity and scenes of naked flesh to slide by, but not a hero with a Marlboro. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't smoke. I don't want children to smoke. I believe that smoking kills. I trust the Surgeon General. We all know the data. The point here is not actually about smoking at all. It's about a culture that would prefer to focus on a cigarette in the hand rather than more obvious moral issues. And, of course, this also goes to the fact that many people claim they aren't hung up on moral issues. Andrew Ferguson, writing the Weekly Standard, says, of course they are. It's just a matter of which moral issues are their particular concern. Ferguson writes, and I quote, some conservatives complain that we live in an immoral age, or an age that's at best indifferent to moral judgment. But this isn't really true. Among a very large majority of people, the need to moralize, to be censorious, to alert our neighbors to the failings of others is undying and ineradicable, as vital as the human need for food or warmth, and the new moralizers, like the old, can't shut up. Now, Andrew Ferguson's a good writer in his own right, and he is on to the fact that we are living in this kind of age in which everyone seems to be talking about their own pet issues. He writes, it's certainly true, as traditionalists say, that the object of the old censoriousness, promiscuity, divorce, abortion, infidelity, have been removed from moral categories altogether and elevated to the status of lifestyle choices, where no one but the chooser himself is allowed to render a moral verdict, and then only on himself. And the verdict, by the way, is pretty much always not guilty. But keep looking. An acquaintance a few years ago urged me to read the New York Times Magazine ethicist column, describing it as unintentionally comic because the writer could never bring himself to cast a strict moral judgment. A weak-kneed relativist is what the columnist was, my acquaintance said, so I started reading the column and was surprised to find that my friend was wrong. This columnist was moralizing to beat the band. And on Sunday morning, Times readers must be disgusted, I thought, until I noticed it was what he was getting moralistic about. One morning, someone wrote in about the eternal yuppie dilemma. Should she buy an SUV? There's no way to justify endangering others, so you just can't play cowboy, the columnist thundered. Anyone who bought an SUV, he said, would be driving straight to hell. And so on, week after week. I became alert to the ways in which our pop culture is shot through with moralism, sulfurous condemnations of homophobia, smoking, guns, junk food, fur, big cars, and this is the big one, judgmentalism. The new church lady simply will not tolerate intolerance, end quote. That's the end of this section from Andrew Ferguson's article. I think his article is brilliant. Now, Andrew Ferguson is almost undoubtedly a bit more, if not much more, libertarian than I am on these concerns. But I'm with him on the central observation that everyone has a list of moral concerns, such that everyone at some point is a moralist about some set of concerns. Now, the way I see it is this. If there are no atheists in foxholes, there are no true moral relativists. There may be people who say they're moral relativists, and when it comes to issues like sexuality, gender, divorce, marriage, and all the rest, they may actually practice moral relativism, but I guarantee you there are other issues of life in which they certainly are not relativists. Just ask their banker. In other words, the most ardent moral relativist teaching in a postmodern professorship in the American elite university still expects that no one can be able to steal from his bank account. We're all moralists about something. Just look at the discourse that goes on. Listen to Hollywood. Hollywood doesn't want anything to do with bourgeois, middle-class, Christian sexual morality, but just get them talking about fur or trans fats or SUVs. Now, if there are no atheists in foxholes, there are no true moral relativists, and all but the truly nihilistic have some moral compass, some moral conviction, some moral causes, even if they are tobacco, trans fats, and SUVs. And let's admit something else. From a Christian worldview perspective, there are moral dimensions to tobacco smoking, trans fats, and SUVs. There's a moral dimension to every aspect of life, rightly understood, and everyone, in the end, has a cause. Now, Christians need to take the argument far beyond Andrew Ferguson's concern. We must note our need for constant moral and theological reflection to ensure that we are maintaining a faithful and mature Christian moral outlook. It's just too easy for us to get sidelined by the inconsequential or to miss the major issues as we immerse ourselves in the minors. So how are we to maintain a faithful moral outlook as Christians? Certainly not by solitary moralizing. We should not be looking in the mirror and having a conversation with ourselves. What we need is robust congregational deliberation, driven by Scripture and guided by the deepest resources of Christian moral thinking. Expository preaching from the pulpit is indispensable, as is the responsible and consistent teaching of Christian parents and leaders. A sense of humility would help, but so would a dose of courage. The fact is, and this is where Andrew Ferguson really nails it, we are all church ladies at heart. Only the Word of God can save us from silliness and set our eyes and hearts on what is truly important. Folks, you know something is wrong in the world when you get the complaints, such as the complaints recorded in the Wall Street Journal today, about a book for boys. It's entitled The Dangerous Book for Boys. It is by Kahn and Hal Iguldin. And by the way, they are both authors, and they've done some great work in terms of historical fiction, especially dealing with Rome, and a new novel out dealing with Genghis Khan. But they've written a book entitled The Dangerous Book for Boys. And when you hear there are concerns, you might think that concern is about the dangerous part. That's not it, folks. It's about the boy part. This book is selling like hotcakes. As a matter of fact, the first day I saw it, I picked it up and I got hooked. It's about all the kind of stuff that boys do find dangerous and do find fascinating. And anyone who has a boy knows why this book would be fascinating. If you tell them about being bitten by sharks and snakes and all the rest, and about climbing walls and making your way through the jungle, how to cook a rabbit, make a battery, and fold a paper hat, boys of all ages are going to be interested in this stuff. But the feminists are upset. They say it should just be the dangerous book for, I don't know, kids, humanoids, human beings, persons of sentient human consciousness, or something like that. They're suggesting that it's just not fair that it's just for boys. Listen to this. One particular website entitled livejournal.com, it had a woman addressing the book and boys in general. This person wrote, "Here's a tip, kiddies. Maybe the girls want to have the same kind of fun you do instead of sitting around the house and learning how to be a servant." Well, the interesting thing here is that this publisher obviously intends to make some money with this book. An executive with the rival publisher, Bertelsmann AG, and in this case, the publisher's official name is Alfred A. Knopf, says he took a copy home to his 8-year-old son, Michael, who he said was junked up on Nick Disney and Club Penguin. The boy missed American Idol in order to get his dad to help him make some stuff out of the book. HarperCollins, the actual publisher of the book, says it has no immediate plans to publish a girl's version, and the publisher, who by the way is a woman, who has two sons and two stepsons, explains her decision this way. Boys are very different. Well, thank you, Ms. Friedman. At least HarperCollins recognizes that. You might have a bestseller on your hands, but finally, a return to common sense would indicate that just maybe boys and girls are different. We'll be back to talk about what has happened to American weddings and why it is that the church has capitulated to the wedding culture. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK, and we'll be right back.
This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program.
If you get any number of Christian pastors together and you ask them to be honest about one of their greatest frustrations, what you're going to hear is a one-word answer: weddings. Oh, you say, how can these Christian pastors be opposed to marriage? Oh, they're not. They're just very much concerned about how weddings have gotten out of control. And they're shocked by the requests that are routinely made to them by even members of their own churches related to weddings. I guarantee you, every time I'm with pastors and fellow pastors talking about this, I hear this over and over and over again. When I was in the bookstore just earlier this week, I saw a book entitled One Perfect Day, The Selling of the American Wedding. I looked at it, started reading it, and I was absolutely hooked. The author is Rebecca Mead, who is a staff writer for The New Yorker. She has written about this in some articles in the past, but now she comes out writing about Bridezilla, the consumer culture, and what has happened to weddings in America. Welcome to the program, Rebecca Mead.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I really was hooked by your book. And,
I
have to tell you, I'm afraid as I take on the subject that I'm going to alienate 52% of the human population here. Well, did you have that fear when you wrote your book?
No, I didn't. You know, I feel as if weddings in America are very, very big business. This is a $161 billion business, and there's an enormous amount of, businesses, companies, individuals who are all trying to get a piece of the action. But, you know, while I was reporting this book, I would tell people what I'm writing about. I would say, you know, I'm writing about the wedding industry and how it has gotten so out of hand and what that says about us as a culture. And so many people would, you know, men and women would say to me, oh, I'm so, so glad that you're writing this, you know, because, you know, I feel that way, and it's time that somebody said it.
Well, I'm glad you got that response, because I can tell you, speaking as one who is a leader in a church and a pastor and minister, and I'll speak on behalf of other ministers, we get a much stronger response.
Well, you know, I mean, your beginning remarks about, Christian ministers saying that this is the part of their work that they, you know, are least happy with. I mean, this is certainly something that I found while I was reporting this. I mean, you know, very often ministers will say, you know, I'd much rather be doing funerals, because at funerals, people are thinking about the important things of life and death and the really significant stuff. And at weddings, there's so much emphasis upon what the bride looks like and what the flowers are like and is the photographer getting the right shots, and nobody's really focusing on what this is really all about.
You mentioned a character now part of American popular culture known as Bridezilla. You mentioned brides who have demanded that their attendants all color their hair the same shade of blonde, others who got some wallpaper from the hotel suite in which they're going to be spending their wedding night so the florist can find blooms or an exact match. You just go on and on. This
right,
is the stuff
right.
A lot of us have actually seen.
Yes, I'm sure you have. And, I think these women who get carried away and get and take their wedding planning to extremes like this, they exist. What interested me, though, was really, you know, why did the caricature of the Bridezilla seize the public imagination in the way that it did? People started talking about Bridezilla in about 2000, and you started to get magazine articles about the behaviors of Bridezilla brides, and you would get, there was a TV series called Bridezilla and a book about Bridezilla behavior. And, you know, everybody seemed to recognize this figure and identify with you know, identify with her and understand that there was such a person. But you know, when a caricature like that is taken up in the public imagination, when it captures the public imagination like that, I think you have to ask, what else is going on here? What larger thing is this a symptom of? And what I think this is a symptom of is a much more widespread discontent among the American public about the direction that weddings are taking, and a much more widespread sense that, you know, wait a minute, this is, you know, it doesn't have to be a $28,000 day, which is the average cost of an American wedding. You know, this isn't really what a wedding is about and what a marriage is about. And so I think that this caricature of the bridezilla, although, you know, figures like that certainly exist and women do behave that way on occasion, is she serves as a kind of safe place in which to quarantine these feelings of disquiet that we all have about something, you know, because nobody wants to be, you know, nobody wants to be down on something as uplifting and as joyful as a wedding. So, you know, we can make fun of the bridezilla and put those feelings of anxiety all over in the corner with the bridezilla and not really worry about what I think is a much larger issue, which is, you know, what does this say about, you know, the state of American culture today, and what does it say about all of us and all of our weddings?
Well, the culture of the wedding in terms of American society today has become a spectacle, something that, at least in Christian tradition, it was never intended to be. Rather than a service of commitment in which a covenant is made publicly and attested to by witnesses, it's now become a huge consumerist jamboree. One of the things you document is the rise of the wedding magazines, of what you call the Walmartization of American weddings. And the expectation that if you really love your children, you're going to pay for this incredibly lavish wedding, which is supposed to make a cultural and social statement.
Right. I mean, you know, I was at a conference for videographers, at which one videographer was giving a seminar to other people in the video business who were beginning their businesses or working on expanding their businesses. And he said, you know, I have one word of advice for you all. Go home and double your prices. You have no idea how much people are willing to spend in order to make their daughter's day the special day that she wants it to be. So there is this idea, you know, and the people in the wedding industry understand very well that this is one occasion in especially in a bride's life when she is willing to pay full price. This is not a time when people are looking for bargains. And, you know, and so people who are in the business of selling brides and grooms services and products know this, and they will, you know, use that to their advantage.
You know, I think the most interesting part of your book to me is, for instance, indicated by this paragraph. This is on page 22 of your book, One Perfect Day. You write, the transition undergone by the contemporary young woman who is marrying for the first time is in fundamental ways much less significant than that experienced by her forebears. Her life as a wife may not be very different from her life pre-engagement in practical terms, but the passage that is passed in the imagination can be profound, and it is upon the bride's expectation of the impending transformation of her inward self to be accomplished through the outward accumulation of stuff that the bridal media work. You know, I have to say, you know, what from a Christian perspective really troubles many of us is that the focus in a society that's decreasingly interested in marriage is increasingly on the wedding as a spectacle. And I see this as basically in what you would have to say is inverse proportion. I mean, the more emphasis upon marriage, maybe the less on wedding, the more on wedding, maybe even the less on marriage. And Ms. Mead, your point here is that given the incredible rates of premarital sex and cohabitation and all the rest, this may not actually be much of a transformation in the individual's life at all.
I think that's right. I mean, you know, I'm not saying that there's not a very big difference between being married and not being married. There is, and I believe that there is. But what I'm saying is that the difference between your life the day before you get married and your life the day after you get married, for many people these days, is not such a big difference. You may already have been living with your spouse. You know, you're not leaving your childhood home. This isn't your transition into adulthood. In many ways, you know, you're already the same person as you're going to be afterwards before it happens.
Hold on just a moment. We've got to go into a break here. We'll be right back. Obviously, this raises a host of issues for all of us. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. And we'll be right back with your calls.
Albert Mueller Program. We won't be taking your phone calls today, but stay tuned for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mueller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
We're asking the big question, have we as American Christians capitulated to a consumerist wedding culture? The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. My guest today is Rebecca Mead, who's a staff writer for New Yorker magazine, author of the book One Perfect Day, The Selling of the American Wedding. Ms. Mead, I want to ask you another question here related to the whole consumerist mentality. You mentioned the fact that the wedding industry has really taken off like a rocket. It even has its own big box stores now.
Yeah, there's a chain of stores called David's Bridal, which provides now one in four of the dresses sold in the United States. So although most of the wedding business is, you know, a lot of it is small mom and pop businesses, you know, the caterers or the florists or whatever, you know, there are these large companies that are involved, and it's also the wedding registry is a very big business for large corporations like the department store corporations and the specialty stores who are very, very eager to get this customer, because if you get a bride to register with your brand, not only do you have the 80-odd guests who are coming to her wedding buying gifts there, but you hopefully cement her loyalty as a consumer for the rest of her life, because you know, the average age for a bride in the United States is 25, for a groom is 27. This is an age at which people are deciding what brands they're going to want to live with for the rest of their lives. And, you know, if she buys all of her cookware from you at the beginning of her marriage, she's going to continue to go back to you. So this is a very, very, very valuable consumer.
All right, let's come back for one other issue, and that is, what would you say is the means of rescue here? Finally, what would you have Americans to do?
Well, you know, I think people need to think about what is a wedding really for. This is something that's very easy to forget when you get swept up in the business of planning, you know, what your flowers are going to be and what your meal is going to be and what kind of hors d'oeuvres you're going to have and what your dress is going to be like and all that kind of thing. And all of that, in fact, is a distraction from the main issue of what a wedding is about and what a wedding is for. And I think that, you know, people have to remember that it's not really about whether you're sending your guests home with personalized M&Ms at the end of the evening. It's really about love and commitment and marriage and family, and that's really what a wedding is about. But there are so many forces now trying to persuade you that what a wedding is your opportunity to be a bridal consumer for the 16 months of your engagement. You know, this is your ability, your opportunity to turn into a consumer of bridal products. I think people need to remember that that's not really what they're getting into.
All right, thank you. That's Rebecca Mead. We appreciate the interview and appreciate your book. Let's go to the callers. Mark's calling from Elizabethton, Tennessee, listening on WHCB. Go ahead, Mark.
Hi, real short here. I know it's an opinionated talk show. I just wish you guys were talking about something more important than this. But anyway,
such as what, Mark?
It comes out to each his own. And if somebody wants to spend, you know, get extravagant on one important day of their whole life, it's like telling somebody, you know, you shouldn't buy a $250,000 home. You should just buy a, $100,000 home or $75,000 home. So,
well, Mark, let me suggest something to you. Let me suggest that that's not all there is to it. Let me suggest to you that a part of the problem is when you hear young people say, we can't afford to get married, not because they can't afford the cost of living together as husband and wife, but because they can't afford a wedding ceremony according to current cultural expectations. You don't see a problem in that?
No, I mean, I think that's being weak to culture. I mean, culture shouldn't make an individual. You should be above culture and be your individual.
Well, if that were true, we wouldn't be having this conversation. And if this issue wasn't important, I assume you wouldn't have taken the time to call. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. The fact is that we are a part of this culture, and the cultural expectations are such that the very point Mark made is the point, in the sense that we can't capitulate to that culture. And the moral judgment he made is, kind of through the back door, I think, the right moral judgment. The fact is, however, We are capitulating to that culture. And that is the problem. We are capitulating to it all over the place. And I can tell you that there are people who would claim to be Christians who will come to a church and make fundamental demands about weddings that are fundamentally non-Christian. You wouldn't believe some of the stuff people want to do in terms of music, in terms of dress, in terms of actions and ceremonies during the wedding itself. Some of them are just perversely non-Christian and even anti-Christian, and yet they demand to do it because it's my day. The phone number, 877-893-8255. We'll be right back.
This is the best of the Albert Mohler program.
Yeah, we all have the stories. We've heard the stories. I can tell you one of the ones I've had to deal with is, for instance, someone demanding Catholic music to be sung in an evangelical worship service without recognizing what's actually being said. Now, I would expect Catholic music to be sung in a Catholic wedding, but Ave Maria is not an appropriate song for an evangelical wedding. And then to hear from people, well, the words don't really matter. Well, I'm sorry, the words do really matter, but there are other people who will simply say, hey, it's my day. I will have it my way. And oh, how that way can get out of hand. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. There are serious theological issues at stake here. One of the big questions is, what's a wedding supposed to be in a Christian context anyway? It is not supposed to be a spectacle. It is not supposed to be a cultural event in which you advertise how much you can spend. It's supposed to be the people of God as witnesses recognizing the solemnization of a covenant, a holy covenant, made between a man and a woman. But I made an argument when I was talking to Rebecca Mead that I firmly believe is true, and that is there's an inverse proportionality between interest in marriage and interest in weddings. This entire consumerist culture about weddings has emerged after we've already begun undermining marriage, and when you're talking in many cases about industries for second and third marriages. Something weird's going on here. I'll tell you what else is going on here. Every single caller right now posted up on the board is a woman. I could be in big trouble. Let's go to Carol, listening on WTBN, calling from St. Petersburg, Florida. Go ahead, Carol.
Hi. I have never called in before, but this is very near and dear to my heart, and I think it's a very important issue. I went through it this past year, and I believe that this has infiltrated the church and that we have forgotten what the ceremony is supposed to be all about, and that we're supposed to be coming before the Lord, making a commitment, having people witness that commitment, and that the body, the family, is supposed to be there to witness. And instead, because it has become important how big of a ceremony and having the sit-down dinner and all the expense involved, it's become exclusive. And it's by invitation only, and people in the family are left out, and it's hurtful, and you don't feel bonded to your, you know, your family there. You don't feel as bonded to them because you weren't invited to the wedding.
Yeah, Carol, hang on with me for a minute. I want to tell you an anecdote just from my own personal experience. I recently heard a family, and it was the father of the groom, speaking to me saying that the way this wedding came together was so expensive, the way that the bride's parents handed out more or less the invitations, they were left with only a couple of dozen invitations for their entire family. But the church was left out, and here's one of the observations he made. He said, you know, there are, and forgive me for putting it just this way, I'm saying this sweetly, there are little old ladies in the church who've been praying for this couple for years and just weren't going to be on the invitation list and couldn't come to the wedding, when you know it would have made their week, their month, to have been there at that wedding, just to have been a part of that. Carol, is that a part of what you're talking about?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. And I just feel like to say how proud I am of my daughter, Jackie, who got married this past year, and her whole intent and purposes was for it to glorify the Lord. And she opened the invitation up to the whole church and said, just please come to the ceremony. And we didn't, and on purpose, we didn't do the sit-down dinner and everything because we wanted the church body to come and celebrate with us.
Well, there's nothing wrong with mixed nuts and mints. That, you know, when I was a little boy going to weddings, that's what I remembered. It was about the only place that I saw some of those mints. And I hate to say that was memorable, but, hey, when you're five or six being dragged along to a wedding, that's what you remember. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with punch and cake. I mean, it's all right. Now, you know, I'm not saying that there's any arbitrary limit to all of this, but I will say something's out of hand when you can't invite the people who love you to a wedding because you can't afford to have them there. Great point, Carol. Let's go to Sherry calling from Greenville, Tennessee, listening to WHCB. Go ahead, Sherry.
Hi, thank you so much for talking about this. I am a mother of two teenage daughters, so I fully expect in the far near future to be wrapped up in all this. But I was wondering, when Mrs. Mead was talking, she talked about the difference before marriage and after marriage not being marketed or not being marketable because of cohabitation and things like that. I'm just wondering if that's why people are pouring so much money into a wedding, to make a memory or a mark of some sort of change that's not physically happening.
You know, Sherry, that is one of the points that Rebecca Mead makes specifically. And that paragraph I read from her book really gets to it. She's not writing from any kind of explicitly Christian perspective at all. She's simply saying, look, if you're already living together and you're already having sex, and so the marriage is not what Christians would understand it of importance to be, which is a solemnization of this covenant, which then enters into marital rights and then the wedding night and all the rest. She said, you then have to turn this into a consumerist event in order that the event becomes the meaning. And Sherry, I think you're just right on there. And I think it's a part of the problem. You know, people shouldn't leave a wedding saying that was one of the most meaningful experiences of my life. The marriage should be the meaningful experience, not the wedding. Now, I'm not saying wedding's unimportant. That's why we believe in formalizing and solemnizing the public exchange of these vows. But in the bottom line, that's what it's really supposed to be. Thanks for your call, Sherry. Let's go to Holly calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Holly.
Yeah, my comment was just, I guess, to the parents that feel like they need to spend so much money to make their daughters feel like they're having a special day. If they feel the need to pour money into this special day, then spend the money on a down payment for their first home. So it's a gift that can live with them forever and not just be consumed in one 24-hour period.
Holly, another very excellent point. Let's just talk about how that plays out very quickly. The average age of a first wedding for a white female in America, according to the 2000 census, was 26. For a white male, 27.5. Part of the reason why that's being put out is because, again, we're extending adolescence, and the wedding's not becoming this great rite of adulthood that it once was. And the other problem is people are saying we can't afford these things, and the rising expectations are a part of that. One of the points that Rebecca Mead makes in her book is that if $28,000 is the average cost of a wedding in America, and by the way, if it's average, that means they're, you know, half of it's probably more expensive than that, then she says that's equivalent to a down payment on a very considerable house for a young couple. And you just think about how that plays off, you know, in an exchange of goods here. You know, we're not legislating this. No, there aren't any laws saying you can only spend so much for your wedding. As far as I know, no one wants to draw up policies that say here's the arbitrary limit for a wedding. But somewhere within the finances of the family and within the purpose for which they're inviting guests in the first place, there ought to be some sanity about how all this comes about. We can't just capitulate to a consumerist culture that says you can't have a decent wedding if you're not spending X number of dollars. We're living in a world in which they are genetically modifying rice to be shaped like hearts so that heart-shaped rice can be thrown at weddings. There's something weird about a world that is growing heart-shaped rice for weddings when there are people dying of starvation in other parts of the world. Right back with some final thoughts. This is the Albert Miller Program.
This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program.
Welcome back, folks. We do try to talk about a mix of things ranging from issues of global concern to the moral dimensions of what goes on in the local church and in family life. And especially on Fridays, it's fun to look at issues like this because they are both, and at the same time, huge cultural issues and the kinds of decision contexts that the Christian families find themselves in repeatedly. And if you have a daughter, you're looking at this in a very, very close way. As that daughter gets older and approaches young womanhood, you know that in all likelihood there's a big bill coming. And you want it to happen. You want her to get married. You want her to be faithfully, happily married. But we as Christians must hope that our children will be far more concerned with the marriage than with the wedding. Wall Street Journal's out with another indicator of something of trouble in our midst. It seems that the generation or the age spectrum right now that is most stressed out is 9 to 12-year-olds. The American Academy of Pediatrics are releasing a report saying that one of the most stressed out age groups in America are elementary, older elementary and middle school students who are so overprogrammed that they find themselves virtually drowning. They have very little time for free play and family togetherness. Instead, they're in every kind of sports league. They're being dragged everywhere. They're in special programs. They have a tutor for this and a tutor for that. And they're expected to get in all these volunteer organizations so that they can get in the right kind of program. And some of them are even trying to build volunteer resumes at age 12. The Wall Street Journal points out that the stresses lead to overtiredness, irritability, falling grades, anxiety, obstinacy, and all the rest. The author of this book, Sue Schnellenberger, writing for the Wall Street Journal, says that her kids, now 16 and 19, say they have forgiven her for signing them up for too much stuff in elementary school, but they admit they were pretty stressed out too. There's something wrong about a society that overprograms children as if they are young adults. There's going to be enough pressure in their lives and times to come. We need to remember that kids are, after all, supposed to be kids, and that having unstructured free time and family time is very important to the development of these children. So from the confusion about weddings to the confusion about childhood, there's ample reason for us to have intelligent Christian conversation about these matters. Today we marked commencement at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, last week at Boyce College, together with 300 graduates. It is a heartwarming event. It's also a sobering event as president of the institution to see these young people go out into the world and imagine what God is going to do in them and through them. It's a heavy sense of stewardship when we recognize that what we have given them is only a start on a lifetime of learning in order to serve the church of the Lord Jesus Christ. And it's another reminder to us of what's at stake when we encourage our own children concerning vocations. How many of you would encourage your child about Christian ministry? Think about that with Christian conviction. I want to congratulate Matthew Hall, the producer of the Albert Mueller Program, who graduated with his Master of Theology degree today. Congratulations to Matt and all those who graduated here and elsewhere. I'll meet you next week for Intelligent Christian Conversation. I'm Albert Mueller.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmueller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmueller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.